Good morning. For decades, how to find and keep newly trained teachers in Hawaii has kept the Department of Education up at night. UH College of Education Dean Donald Young takes a long look at teacher retention and what his department is doing to help it. Meanwhile, you could be among those who routinely lose sleep. In advance of a Hawaii conference, neurologist Michael Russo details some of the current findings on disorders and their projected prevalence. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. A documentary film to be shown on Maui, Body and Soul, the State of the Jewish Nation, looks at the historical connection between the Jewish people and the land of Israel. And Kauai celebrates Makahiki season with a full complement of traditional sports, dances, and celebrations.
It's Thursday, February 2nd, Groundhog Day. It's Thursday, February 2nd, Groundhog Day. Join us for the conversation. Now news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
As folks who get up at well before the crack of dawn, we know from not getting enough sleep, don't we?
Yeah, I would say for a lot of journalists, that's exactly the case. I mean, we've heard what time the folks from Morning Edition have to be arriving to be able to record pieces in the morning before they hit air at 5 o'clock Eastern time.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's not necessarily a good thing for our health, as we've also heard. Now, but even if you count your blessings instead of sheep, there's a good chance that even after you've exhausted your list, you might still be awake. Although insomnia is just one form of sleep disruption, the Centers for Disease Control says that between 50 and 70 million Americans try to cope with lack of normal sleep. Breathing, sleep wake, or movement disorders are some of the other reasons. Neurologist Michael Russo is the co-founder of the Hawaii Sleep and Wellness Foundation. It's sponsoring a conference this month to sensitize health providers to some of the latest research on sleep. Dr. Russo, welcome.
Good morning. Thank you, Beth Ann.
We have for a long time heard that, people need to get a good night's sleep. And if you're not getting 7 or 8 hours, you're not getting a good night's sleep. At the same time, we seem to be in an environment where sleep is not really truly valued and that you're thought kind of, wussy if you say, I got to get to sleep. When we look at that idea with how many people we think are sleep deprived, how many people are we really talking about? In Hawaii?
There's a great number of people who do not get enough sleep because they're bullied into having to perform more tasks in a given day. Spending 7 to 8 hours in bed is not necessarily equating to spending that kind of time sleeping. You sleep with a greater efficiency if you're sleep deprived, maybe 90%, but the normal person should sleep at a sleep efficiency of about 80%. And if they're getting 8 hours time in bed, they're probably sleeping about 7 hours.
So for the number of people that might have sleep disorders in Hawaii, based on some of the national research that we have, because my understanding is there is no real research that's based in Hawaii, how many people could possibly be having sleep disorders and not really know it and perhaps not even be discussing it with their doctors because they're thinking it's something else?
There could be as many as 400,000 individuals here in Hawaii with sleep disorders. There may be 300,000 or so who have obstructive sleep apnea, about 25% of the population. Difficulty breathing at night that then awakens them, fragments their sleep, and results in poor daytime performance.
That's a lot of people, given our relatively small population of 1.4 million people. And once you discount kind of kids from that, what happens when somebody is having these issues and that person may go to his or her doctor thinking that maybe it's something else? Does a doctor routinely talk about sleep and ask? Is that something that you hear from other docs in Hawaii is really one of the first questions they ask?
Not often enough is it asked about. Usually when a physician asks about something, they're obliged to then diagnose and treat it. And if the physicians don't know enough about the sleep disorders, how to diagnose them, how to treat them, they're less likely to ask about them. Hence our desire to educate the physicians as well as the patients that there are good diagnostic techniques and good treatments for sleep disorders.
And that's more than just here's your prescription for fill in the drug.
Oh, it should not first be give a drug. There's too much prescribing of Ambien or prescribing of sleeping pills without a correct diagnosis of the cause of the sleep problem. Sometimes these sleeping pills could make an individual worse rather than better.
The idea that, you know, first do no harm for a physician seems to be in conflict with what you just said. If it's a matter of trying to really winnow out the sleep issues that could be treated non-pharmaceutically with the knee-jerk reaction of here is something that's going to make you sleep. How do you begin to change that mindset within the Hawaii medical community?
By educating the physicians, the dentists, anyone who has patients who may have sleep disorders, teaching them that there are ways to diagnose the disorder before then treating it, before then giving a medication that may not help them.
What has to happen for a patient to be able to maybe think first that it may be something having to do with sleep?
Often it's the spouse will tell the husband, you have to do something about that snoring. Sometimes it's an automobile accident where the patient has fallen asleep, run off the road, hit another car, and been told, okay, you have a sleep problem. You're too sleepy. Do something about it.
Really, it's that prevalent to where that would be a trigger for someone?
I see patients who have automobile accidents due to falling asleep on the road weekly. And I have to advise them, no driving until they get their sleep disorder diagnosed and treated.
I mean, that's a frightening thought. I mean, you could be out there on the road, and if you're seeing at least, you know, a couple of people weekly who are having that issue, then that puts other people at risk, too. That's far more than just a spouse saying to the other one, hey, you better do something about that snoring. But while we're talking about that, is it usually a woman who says to her husband, I mean, that's a very, you know, maybe typical situation that we see and have seen for a long time on TV or just, you know, talk about as being a cliche. But is that really more prevalent than a female who snores?
Females snore also. It's usually the wife who identifies the husband as having a problem. Then the husband shoots back, well, you snore too. So it's often the wife who wakes up to identify that the husband needs to be rolled over in bed to stop the snoring.
There are over-the-counter aids that are advertised for that. Do they work?
Well, Benadryl, for example, it's an antihistamine. Histamines will keep you awake. Antihistamines will help you to go to sleep. So they do work under some circumstances, but not if you have a drive to awaken. If you have a drive to awaken to breathe, you don't want something that's going to push you into a deeper state of sleep while your body is struggling to awaken to breathe.
But the over-the-counter devices, you know, the breathe rights, those kinds of things that are said to help.
They can help in some circumstances. Say the breathe right attempts to open up the nasal passages. There's something called the nasal trigon, which could collapse when you inhale through your nose. It's an attempt to open that up to allow greater airflow.
And just in general, though, because when people have to get a decent night's sleep, and there may be a lot of people for whatever reason, because they're having breathing problems or because there's, you know, sleep-wake disorders, or they just are the kind of people who have a circadian rhythm that makes them more, say, night owls than morning larks, but they have to be able to get up very early in the morning. How do you advise them to be able to change that rhythm?
Well, they should not awaken early, say 3 days a week, and then try to awaken it other times, say 4 days a week. It should be consistent. 7 days a week, stick with whatever schedule it is you wish to stick with. Avoid light at the end of the day, even if it is daylight, if you wish to wake up at 3 a.m. Give yourself bright light when you wake up at 3 a.m. Try to shift your circadian rhythm to that which you wish to stay at on a day-to-day basis.
But if somebody is waking up at 3 o'clock, and as you've mentioned elsewhere, that the body is moving downward temperature-wise to the low at 4 in the morning, and then it starts to increase again, which is moving toward wakefulness, can you really trick your body if your body rhythm is moving at that point, thinking that 4 o'clock is really the low?
It takes a long time to change the body's rhythm. If you were to wake up at 5 in the morning, it would be a lot easier to do so than to wake up at 3 in the morning. But if you're going to wake up at 3 in the morning every day, it should be every day, and you should be consistent about it to sort of trick your body into thinking that 3 in the morning is 5 or 6 or 7 in the morning.
All right. Well, we'll have to check that out with Derek Malama. Thank you so much for joining us, and good luck with being able to get the word out a little bit more that maybe we should be a little more concerned about sleep and not look at it as the stepchild.
Well, the conference is 10 and 11 February. Please join us at the Hawaiian Hilton.
Thank you. Dr. Michael Russo is a neurologist and vice president of the Hawaii Sleep and Wellness Foundation. The Sleep Disorder Conference will be held on February 9th through 11th at the Hilton Hawaiian Village. We'll have details about it on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
If you're worried and you can't sleep, just count your blessings instead of sheep. And you'll fall asleep counting your blessings.
Why the original idea of the American melting pot failed.
When I say that these enlightened, liberal Americans believed in the kind of potential equality of people of color, they believed in their potential to become like white people.
A historian provocatively reveals the seeds of segregation in early America, a seed we may be harvesting today. That's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
You're listening to The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, a fresh look at Israel's history. But first, here's your backyard quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, we're thinking about a rustic mountain lodge that was built in part on the remnants of a Maui military installation. It was opened in August 1947 as an official part of Hawaii National Park. Its cabins were converted from abandoned structures that became the property of the Department of the Interior after the end of the Second World War. The department granted a business concession permit to create a visitor attraction to take advantage of the spectacular mountain views the site offered. The original managers were a brother and sister team, Robert Von Temsky and Alexa Von Temsky-Zabriskie. They opened their mountain lodge in style with a VIP reception and a horseback excursion for guests. The renovated dining room seated 60, and room rates ran as low as $7.50 a night. It's fondly remembered by Kama'aina, and we're wondering if you can tell us its original name. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And the first one to get it right will get a prize.
Aloha, I'm Kent from the Japanese American Citizens League. You're tuned in to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Continue the conversation with us by following us on Twitter. Our handle is @HIConversation.
On May 14th, 1948, in Tel Aviv, David Ben-Gurion said, We hereby proclaim the establishment of the Jewish state in Palestine to be called Israel, and the validity of that proclamation has been challenged by Israel's enemies ever since. But to Jews around the world, Israel is a nation whose roots go back not decades, but thousands of years. This Sunday, Maui's Beit Shalom Synagogue will screen a documentary film called Body and Soul, The State of the Jewish Nation, that offers a historical perspective on that beleaguered country. And Beit Shalom's Hannah Rose tells us more. Good morning, Hannah.
Good morning, Chris.
Why is this an important story to tell and a story to tell now?
Well, I think it's important on a couple counts. One, there's just so much misinformation out there. Some of it is propaganda, media distortions, and to be honest, the generation currently doesn't really know the history of the Jewish nation, particularly its ancient history.
Because most people would say, well, since 1948, right?
Yes, that's where they pretty much pick up the story, but it actually goes back for more than 3,000 years.
And how is that, how is that supported in the film, or how is it supported just in general?
Well, in the film itself, Gloria Greenfield has done an excellent job of bringing together over 36 academics and experts in political science, archaeology, international law, and the media to just bring forward an undeniable case for the historical connection between the Jewish people and the land of Israel that goes back at least 3,000 years.
Well, you referred to media distortions earlier. What are some? What would you consider a media distortion?
Well, I think that a classic example is just recently the UN has passed a resolution 2334, which denies the historical connection of the Jewish people to Jerusalem and the Temple Mount in particular. And, of course, the media has backed that up and kind of promotes one side of the story. And it seems to ignore the historical connection of the Jewish people to this area.
The media have backed it up? I mean, that sounds as if the media were a single unit. And I'm sure there have to be several different perspectives out there, aren't there?
You're right, Chris. I mean, it's not. It's just the overall consensus seems to see that they portray Israel more as the strong oppressor against the weaker Palestinian people, rather than bringing a more balanced perspective of what's really going on. I'm afraid that sometimes that the media picks up on the emotional side of the story and doesn't really back it up with the facts of the matter.
Well, that's kind of in the nature of, headline-driven journalism. I mean, obviously, the UN announcement was a story, and when you present that story, it's hard to not make that seem like maybe like an opinion piece, especially when you don't get the other side. But that's what this film is intended to do, essentially, provide a wider perspective. Is that right?
Absolutely. It just addresses some of the distortions and tries to present Israel's side of the story and back it up with facts. You know, let's kind of put our emotional differences aside and let's really look at the history. Let's look at the facts historically, legally, on, many different levels. Let's just see what is the truth of the matter. And that's what Gloria Greenfield has strive to do in this film. In fact, her production company, Doc Emmett Productions, is their motto is truth in film. So we're trying to portray the truth here. So you cannot bring peace by basing things on emotional arguments. You have to look at the facts and work from there on a solid foundation of truth.
Sadly, it often seems to me, Hannah, that in today's media environment that facts aren't nearly enough,
Well, facts don't always sell. Emotional things. You know, you need something exciting and emotional and a cause for the people to rally behind. That's what sells. That's what the media tends to focus on. And I'm not saying all of them. Obviously, you guys, which I'm very thankful, are willing to look at the other side and acknowledge Israel's history in this area. But most media just seems to go with what headlines are really going to capture the people and get the audience.
Well, I mean, that's admittedly a failing of you know, 24-hour news cycles. But in the documentary, Hanna, what kind of evidence is presented?
Wow. Well, there are, it covers like 3,000 years of history of the Jewish people in this area. They're going to cover the archaeological evidence. There are world-renowned historians that are interviewed. It's kind of a documentary here of just showing the facts, and also brings in international law, because there were many laws that were enacted even before the state of Israel was formed or reformed in 1948 that give it undeniable legal rights to this land according to international law. And so these things are all brought out in the film.
You would think that rights that you describe as undeniable wouldn't be so widely denied. But there seem to be some ancient conflicts in play here.
There are definitely ancient conflicts in play here, but there's also, beyond that, we're kind of witnessing a renewed intellectual assault on the Jewish state. And the BDS movement is a classic example of that, the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, where they're trying to delegitimize the Jewish state.
Well, we wish you, luck in getting your message out, Hanna, and thanks very much for telling about this.
Thank you very much, Chris. I hope everybody will show up, this Sunday night at the Jewish Congregation of Maui. That's in Kihei.
We'll send people your way. Hanna Rose is a member of the Beit Shalom Synagogue in Kihei, Maui. It'll present a free screening of the documentary Body and Soul, The State of the Jewish Nation. That's this Sunday at 6:30 p.m.
I'm Tom Ashbrook, host of WBUR's and NPR's On Point, and I'm thrilled that Hawaii will soon be joining our lively national conversation. Tune into On Point on HPR 1 Mondays through Thursdays at 2 p.m. starting February 14th. We look forward to hearing from you, and again, you'll hear us on HPR 1 soon, the news and talk stream for your On Point Hawaii Public Radio.
There's more to the ongoing saga of the outgoing HPD chief's severance package. Part of the parting agreement is a $250,000 payout approved by the Honolulu Police Commission. But the acting head of HPD says they just don't have the money. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair joins us now with a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
So we've got one body acting sort of in principle, the other caught with having to carry out the practical application. How is that possible?
Well, I don't know that we've had a recent case where the police commission, is paying a chief to retire on good standing. Of course, Louis K. Aloha is also under a federal investigation probe regarding corruption. But yesterday, Acting Chief Kerry Okimoto told the commission, look, we don't have $250,000. If we're going to take that money out of our budget, we're going to have to cut something else. Another officer said, well, what are we going to do? Are we going to stop testing sex assault kits? Are we going to stop buying tasers? So these are the kind of questions that HPD is concerned about. It appears that they will probably go to the city council to see if they can get some money for this. But there you have another twist, because the council wasn't involved with the police commission settlement. Some members there are concerned about it. Remember, it's the council that normally approves legal financial settlements, but in this case, it's the commission that did it. And then there's the question about whether the commission really has any authority over the budget of HPD. The city charter does say that it's allowed to review the budget and make recommendations to the mayor. It's kind of vague on whether they can actually order the police department to pay right. $250,000 to the former chief or the soon-to-be former chief.
When you have these layers upon layers of authority or pseudo-authority, how then do we look at this payout? Is this something that could conceivably be kicked back and kicked around and not actually happen?
One wonders if that is going to happen. Remember, there's also a lawsuit from the Civil Beat Law Center concerning the whole process of dealing with Chief Kealoha that was done in executive session. That's another thing they're going to have to deal with. We can tell you that Max Sword, the police commission chairman, says, look, we're moving on. We got other things that we have to deal with. One of the things they have to deal with is finding another police chief. And here there's another twist from Nick Gruby in his report. They are looking at out-of-state candidates. It's probably going to take 4 to 6 months to vet. But get this. There's actually a state law that says you have to live in Hawaii for at least 1 year. Now, that would seem to be a bit of a challenge for out-of-state candidates. So these are the kind of at least one big challenge the commission has going forward. By the way, it looks like they're going to get a consultant to help them with it. It sounds like they need a lot of help in their search for a new police chief.
I don't mean to laugh because this is such a serious matter. But when you think about how all these pieces don't align, you know, there's a lot of dark humor in that. But unfortunately, the people who are going to get shut out are is the public.
Yeah, and it is ultimately our money. These are tax dollars that are going to be used here. Remember, there's also payments for legal fees for Kealoha. So it's going to be a continuing story.
Oh, so much ka-ching and so much uncertainty. And this thing is just fraught. Okay, well, no doubt you and I will have much more to talk about as this continues. Thanks, Chad.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
We'll talk with Chad Blair tomorrow morning and get another reality check. If you've lived in Hawaii for any length of time, think back for just a minute to your earliest awareness of Hawaii's school system. You probably don't have to think long. Hawaii's teacher shortage, for example, is a perennial issue for Hawaii's Department of Education. The narrative that we hear about the school system usually includes something like this. Teaching here is difficult, school management is inconsistent, and it's tough to make a living wage. Then there's often the repeated idea that teachers generally aren't that great and Hawaii can't retain what good ones it has, so it's always running after whatever teachers it can corral. Now, UH College of Education Dean Donald Young and I sat down recently to consider what it would take to grow and retain more teachers in Hawaii. Here's our conversation.
It's interesting that all of a sudden it's getting new attention, but this has been a persistent problem for at least 40-some years. I came here originally when there was a teacher shortage. So this is not a new problem. We're seeing new things going on in the context. In our College of Education, for example, we haven't been impacted until this last year with declining enrollment. Nationally, that's happened across the country. But now we're finding that for the first time, our undergraduate enrollment for teacher preparation programs is down. Fortunately, our graduate programs for teacher preparation is up. But part of it is the narrative. I mean, we've had the last two decades under No Child Left Behind, under what I'll describe as probably more draconian accountability. Accountability is a good thing, but when it's taken to a negative degree and only relying on test scores, it's changed the narrative about teaching and what teaching is all about. So we work really hard with our College of Education candidates to prepare them to teach in very creative and open ways. But the narrative hasn't changed in the public. And one of the things that I think the larger context is all of us, parents, teachers, K-12, higher education, the legislature, need to find ways to talk more positively and show shining examples of the good things that are happening in our schools because they far outweigh the negative.
Is teaching still a calling?
Certainly is. I've got undergraduate students in our college right now preparing to be teachers. I've talked with them frequently, particularly the president of our undergraduate student association. He's committed to being an elementary teacher. He came out of the science. He was going to go into biology. Now he's in education. He's committed to be an elementary teacher, despite the fact that in the stories he tells is he's had parents and unfortunately even teachers telling him not to go into teaching. So these are really the people that we want to attract into the profession. And he's a shining example, and we'll tell that story frequently to fellow students across campus.
He seems to be, from what you've just described, an example of what we've heard in other areas where someone has persisted despite a lot of the negative press or negative storytelling about that profession, but especially with teachers, because we all like to pay such, it seems like, lip service to how important they are in our children's lives, and yet it's been so fraught, as you mentioned, for 40 years. At this point, when we hear from HSTA that teachers need to be better paid, and yet we know they also want to make a difference and are choosing as those who get to that point. What has to happen? Is there another component to this that we really aren't looking at, especially now that states have more control under the Every Student Succeeds Act?
Well, theoretically, they have more control. We'll see how it actually plays out. But what else needs to happen? Certainly, I will applaud HSTA's efforts at raising teacher salaries. When we're looking at an undergraduate major coming out in recommended for licensure and the starting salaries, certainly salary is part of it, but it's also their calling. Folks aren't going into teaching as a career for the salary alone. Salaries have to be high enough in Hawaii so that you can actually put food on the table, not have to have a second job, because everyone who really pays attention to what happens in schools and classrooms knows teaching is hard work. It's really hard work, and it doesn't end at the end of the day. It goes on into the evening with teacher preparation, professional development on nights and weekends. It's a very challenging job. So, yes, it's a calling, and it's also a profession that's very rewarding, but it also has to have the financial rewards and working conditions that are conducive to making people really want to go to work in the morning.
That seems to be where there are a lot of issues, too, where there can be people at schools, colleagues, or a principal that seem to thwart some of those teachers who believe that teaching really is their calling, some of the people that you have in your graduate program. How do you begin to circumvent those people and not have them undercut those who come in with that fervor for teaching and allow them to be able to do some of the more innovative things that we're now told are highly important for creating what we're going to need in the future, even though we don't know what we're going to need in the future?
I guess the things that come to mind immediately are some of the things that we're trying to do in the college. Let me just rattle off some. These are supports that we're providing for our graduates after they're employed. So we've got three faculty members, for example, now who are part of what we call our song team, supporting our new graduates. And they work with those new graduates for 2 years into employment on precisely these issues. Where do I need some additional help with content? Where do I need just somebody to talk to? Where do I need moral support? Where can I get help to counter some of the narratives that I'm seeing in school? So that's one. Another area is we've worked really hard, and we've found that reengaging our graduates in that 3 to 5 year period after they have graduated and engaging them in certificate programs, professional development opportunities for advancement, either through certificates or another degree. We've seen teachers come back into, for example, we've got a new teaching certificate in literacy. Some things that we've learned since they were graduates. So if we can reengage them in how they can be more successful with the students that they're teaching. So those seem to be paying high dividends. The data are inconclusive right now because we've only been at this about 3 years. So we're still targeting that 3 to 5 year period when the bulk of our teachers seem to be leaving the profession.
Last week, I had a chance to again talk with Tony Wagner, who is in town and in the state, working with teachers and schools and educators and interested others in bringing different ideas to the table in this era of innovation. And one of the things that, you know, he talked about regarding teaching is that teachers are often isolated, too isolated, and that they don't have a chance to model the kind of behavior and the kind of learning environment and the kind of collaborative activities that will be incumbent upon kids to be involved with as they get into adulthood and into whatever their fields may be, because it all seems to be moving in that direction. What would you say about this idea that we need to have more team teachers and teachers who are involved in so many things, not just a science teacher or here's a group of science teachers, but where you have the integration of so much of the curriculum?
I guess I'd react to 3 points. Number one is what you described Tony saying about the ecology of school. There's an old quote that was at least probably 40 years old and describes that as the egg crate ecology. Each teacher isolated in their own classroom and hardly ever, except in the coffee room, interacting with someone else. We're working really hard to change that. A lot of what we're doing in teacher preparation is engaging them in teams. All of our teacher preparation programs, by the way, are in cohorts. Students stay with the same group of students throughout that program. So they build very close relationships. They learn how to network and support and rely on one another. And those relationships exist far beyond just preparation. They exist into employment as well. The third point is simply this. Just expecting teachers to team and work together won't cut it. There has to be specific training on how do you team, how do you facilitate, how do you energize a team, how do I commit my part in support of a team, how do I become a team leader. So a lot of those things we're trying to build into our teacher preparation programs and especially into our master's degree program.
Do you have a sense that it really is changing in that direction from what you've seen? Because to build it in and to see it, but maybe there isn't enough longitudinal data for that kind of result to be seen yet?
I think to make it really successful in the kinds of things you're talking about, we need to see how we can use scheduling of time within the school better. And some schools are doing this, of how can you create time when, at least at a department level, teachers can get together during the workday. So those things are happening. It does take some creative scheduling to make it happen. I think HSTA has been influential in this, too, in building in professional development days into the contract so that there's dedicated time for teachers to learn how to do some of these things.
I want to thank you for sitting down with me today.
My pleasure.
Donald Young is the Dean of the College of Education at the University of Hawaii at Manoa.
Support for The Conversation comes from Hawaii Life Real Estate Brokers, serving Oahu, Maui, Kauai, and the Big Island of Hawaii. Listings and information at hawaiilife.com.
Tonight at 5, Bethany will be bringing us Town Square and looking at the consequences, intended and otherwise, of the President's executive order on immigration and travel.
And yesterday we saw 21 groups come together and issue a joint statement. And yesterday morning on this program, we talked with Clara Hannes, who is an immigration attorney who was deeply involved with a couple of those organizations.
Sure.
And really, this is a larger conversation, and we wanted to give everyone the chance to be able to participate in that conversation, look at it from different angles, not only just to talk about it, but say, you know, what do we do beyond that point? What does it mean for us? So Clara Hannes will be back again tonight. Also, Hakim Unsafi, the chair of the Muslim Association of Hawaii, and Dr. Tin Myung Tien, the executive director of the Pacific Gateway Center, plus Mateo Caballero, the legal director of the ACLU of Hawaii. And we're going to sit down and really take this apart more than just, you know, saying, here's the statement.
And this is a story that's going to be with us for a while. This is not the consequences aren't going away.
And that's the point. That really is the point. What are those consequences, and what do they mean for Hawaii families, for Hawaii students, for faculty, you know, foreign-born faculty,
sure.
all kinds of issues that we began to touch on yesterday, but we have many more stories and many more issues to bring to the table tonight, this table, when we meet up at 5 o'clock.
And lots of opportunities for people to call in, which they should if they want to know more about this. Right?
Well, that's the point. Add to the conversation tonight at 5. In today's backyard quiz, we reminded you of a rustic mountain lodge that opened on Maui after the end of the Second World War. The site was dotted with cabins converted from a wartime military installation, and the grounds were on land run by the Department of the Interior's National Park Service. The lodge ran its own bus from the airport to its mountainside lodge and kept a stable of 40 horses and mules to take guests on excursions. Maui Kamaaina families remember sunset dinners with spectacular mountain views and leisurely horseback trips through the area. But winter weather at the lodge's high elevation, strong winds, well, that all proved to be the downfall of the enterprise. It became impossible to sustain the visitor attraction as a business during those colder months, and eventually the Haleakala Mountain Lodge and its successor, the Silver Sword Inn, went under. Those were the names that we were looking for today, and unfortunately, nobody provided us with either one of those, so we'll just keep our prize for tomorrow. Now, if you've got a backyard quiz for us, though, you can always send it in. Our address is talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Aloha, I'm John Johnson from One Breath Photography. You're tuned to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Learn more about what you hear on the show at facebook.com/HIConversation.
It's the kind of cultural practice we wish we could spread all over the world. Suspension of conflict in a time of games, celebration, and dances to honor the earth's bounty. Makahiki season is underway, and Kauai's Kamoku Omano Kalanipo Pa'ani Makahiki is on for this weekend. Julie Kane'ali'i is one of the coordinators, and she's on the phone from Waimea. Good morning, Julie.
Hi, good morning, Chris.
Don't you wish everybody had Makahiki all over the world? It'd be a kind of a nice settling down of a lot of things, wouldn't it?
I do, especially watching the news this morning. It's very troubling.
Well, the whole, because part of it is that whatever conflicts that were ongoing between people, city-states, any kind of interest groups were suspended during Makahiki, right?
Yes, absolutely, they were. And on to fun and happy times.
Well, how does that take hold in a community? I mean, was that something that everyone just sort of agreed to and laid down their weapons back in the pre-contact days?
Yes, it was. It was a time of year that was designated, so it was an annual thing. Everybody knew that it was happening, and everyone was involved, and I guess on the same page with the way that life was during the Makahiki season.
The impetus being the harvest, is that right? Is that accurate?
During this time?
Yeah.
The crops were already harvested, so the land was let to lay fallow so it could rejuvenate. So it was a time for the land and the people to be able to rest and rejuvenate for the upcoming for the time after Makahiki season was over.
In a way, so people sort of emulate the rhythms of the earth itself, it sounds like.
Absolutely, yes. The Hawaiian people were definitely connected to everything and knew that this time, especially when it was raining so much, you know, it's hard when it's raining. I live in one of the rainiest spots in Waimea on Kauai.
Oh, yeah.
And so you know when it's raining, you can't really get out and do your yard work and tend to things like you need to be. And so instead of fighting Mother Nature, you go with what's happening.
That's probably just as well. So you're in one of those areas on Kauai where you get hundreds of inches a year, yeah?
Yes, we do. We do. And I've lived on Kauai quite a number of years, and I didn't realize how much rain this one valley gets. But it's absolutely beautiful and amazing.
Well, you were obviously adapted to it.
Oh, yes, you have to. You have to. It's 68 degrees here. I just went and looked at the temperature. I'm absolutely freezing. I'm all bundled up. All the windows are closed. And I'm not doing anything.
Well, good for you. That's as good a way to celebrate as
well. I shouldn't say anything. I am going over my checklist to make sure that we're ready and prepared for this weekend.
Well, and quite a bit of preparation is called for in an event
mm-hmm.
like this, right?
It is, yeah. There's a lot of little details with putting this on. We're offering 10 games, so we have to make sure that all our implements are in order. And we have all the awards, and that's kind of the main focus is the games and the people that are, you know, will come out and participate in them and focusing on that. We've added a craft fair. We do have food booths, and we have some people that from the community who are doing some outreach, to let people know what their organizations are doing. But the main focus is the games.
Well, and Makahiki comes with a full complement of games that have long been associated with Makahiki coming out of pre-contact days. What are some of them, Julie?
Some of the ones that we're offering are Hakamoa, which is the chicken fighting, Ulumaika, O'o'ihe, Moa Pahe'e, Pa'uma, Uma, Kukini, and the ever-popular Huki Huki, which is the tug of war. Everybody absolutely loves to do that.
I bet.
Yeah. Yeah. So those are just, and Konane. We do a Konane tournament. So we just decided to focus on those particular games. But there were hundreds of games that were associated with Makahiki.
Well, Julie.
And different levels of them.
If you would, just give me a quick capsule description of a couple of the ones that you just mentioned.
Oh, okay. So, O'o'ihe is throwing a spear at a banana stump. In ancient times, it was a way for warriors to practice, and they would throw the spears at each other. But we have a lot of school-age children, and so we're doing banana stumps.
Yeah, I think that's...
We figured that would be a good idea.
I think that's some variation is called
right,
for.
Right. And then we have Kukini, which is running. So we do a 50-yard for the younger kids and a 100-yard dash for the older division. Pa'uma is the standing wrist wrestling. Uma is where you lay down on the ground and you're clasping hands and you try to get the opponent's hand down to the ground. So a lot of them are very similar to things that we know in the Western culture.
Sure, sure.
Ulumaika is rolling a stone, and then Moa Pahe'e is a sliding dart. So those are kind of, I think, two of the most popular. The kids really love the Ulumaika.
In ancient times, these were sort of, and that's true of a lot of games and sports, that they're sort of peacetime celebrations of warrior skills, right? Throwing spears, wrestling, that kind of thing.
Yes, it was a way to keep the warriors fit during the downtime.
So there's a little bit of an acknowledgement that... Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, so that was... Yeah, that's one part of the games and the activities that happened. Because it was for everyone. It wasn't just for the men.
Well,
participate in. Yeah.
What kind of turnout have you had in years past, and what kind of turnout do you anticipate, Julie?
Well, it's interesting because we decided, like the Lono banner in ancient times went around the island in a clockwise manner, that we would take it to four major districts on Kauai. So we did Hanalei in the beginning, Kapa'a, Koloa. This year is Waimea, so that will complete the circle. And every year it's different. It's mainly been from the school, the kids that are from the school in the area. So we've had between 100 and 150 people actually participate in the games.
Well, Julie, given your location, I wish you good weather for this Saturday.
It's going to be, yeah, I think it's going to be beautiful. A little chilly with the winds coming down from Kauai, but that'll be nice so you know, everyone participating won't get too overheated. But we were just out there yesterday taking a look at everything, and it was just absolutely beautiful.
Well, you know, there are lots of people around the world who don't consider 68 degrees particularly chilly, but they don't live here, do they? Thanks a lot, Julie. Julie Kane'ali is one of the coordinators of the Kamoku o Mano Kalanipo Pa'ani Makahiki this Saturday at the Waimea Athletic Field on Kauai. And you can get details on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Matson, completing the 15th year of their Kaipu Aina program, partnering with charities that clean litter from our islands, shores, and parks. Learn more at matson.com/foundation.
What does the public in Hawaii Public Radio mean? It means we're available to everyone and free of commercial influences. It means reporting to help you be a more informed decision maker, whether it's political hearings of national importance, in-depth coverage of events here and abroad, interviews that provide insight and context. Your financial support puts all of that on the air. If you're already an HPR member, mahalo. If you're yet to contribute to make this important public service possible, please go to our website today, and thank you.
Well, Beth Ann, let's hope all our listeners got enough sleep last night.
Or will, hopefully, tonight. We know that's not reality, though. And as we talked about at the top of the program, many reasons for that. But also to have that be a simple reason that you talk about when you go see your doctor and not be afraid to bring up the fact that you're not sleeping well.
We're learning more and more about its importance to overall health, aren't we?
Right. And few are the people who can just simply put their head on a pillow and go to sleep. I'm married to one. I hate him. I'm kidding. But in truth, yeah, sleep is really, really important. Now, you likely heard that Representative Beth Fukumoto could leave the GOP over deep concerns with the party, and the GOP doesn't seem to be upset about the prospect. We'll talk with her tomorrow in our studio.
And we'll meet jazz singer Karen Allison on our show tomorrow as well.
Just a reminder, we are moving to HPR 1, airing at 11 a.m. You can find us on your FM dial at 88.1 and 88.5 on Oahu and 91.1 in Hilo, 97.7 for Maui County, 94.9 and 89.1 in East Hawaii. Lots more. They're all on our website.
And if you like the music from today's show or want to hear one of our stories again or the entire program, look for us under Talk Shows for the Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. See you tomorrow.